Okay, you guys, it's now time for the speaker to come on stage, so let's everybody give her the attention that she needs and deserves, and offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Maria.
Hi there. My name's Maria. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here, and I'm just excited that there's so many new faces, new people here that are just getting started in recovery. That's the purpose of any meeting, is really to pass it on. And it makes it worth sitting through 25 minutes of announcements and housekeeping. So I am going to share my experience, strength, and hope, or what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. This past March 7th, I celebrated 21 years of sobriety. And I've been really lucky in that it was a continuous sobriety. I don't have a relapse story.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful for that. I got here, when I got here, I would have qualified for young people's. So I was 25 years old, almost 26. And I didn't come here on my own decision. So that's something I like to get out of the way and let people know all the time when I share in meetings, is that you can get it even if somebody else sent you here. I never would have thought that I was an alcoholic, not in a million years. Everybody I knew, everybody I grew up with, everybody in my family all drank like I did. So what's the problem? You know, and for me, it was drugs that took me down so fast and allowed me to get sober at such a young age. And I have all respect for AA meetings, so I won't go into lots of details about that, but it's just a part of my story, you know, and it wouldn't be complete without mentioning it. So my family is a big Italian family from New York. That's where I grew up. And we had every single holiday with tons of cousins and uncles, and I was drinking at a very young age. So I was just like the drink courier or the waitress. And I loved that job because I got to take a sip, you know. So I take a sip at the top and I take the sip at the bottom on my way there and on my way back. And I knew how to make the drinks, and I knew how to make the scotch soda, and I knew how to make the vodka tonic, and I knew that a lime went in the tonic and a lemon went in the soda. And I knew how Uncle Ernie liked his double scotch, and I knew how, you know, the cousins liked their beer and who liked what beer, because, you know, we're Italians, and so you get tips too. So, you know, at 9 years old, I had the hustle down, you know, and I knew who was going to give me some money, and I knew who I wanted to sit on the big lounge chairs where there'd be lots of change the next day when they were all drunk. And so it was just like, you know, every New Year's Day and after every big party was just like walking over bodies everywhere and looking for loose change. And if there was recycling back then, I would have collected the cans, but they weren't giving you money for them yet. And so I took my first sips real young, but the first time that I ever experienced a real, like, psychic change, you know, from drinking, I think I was probably in about sixth grade, and we used to hit the Bailey's Irish Cream, and that just tasted like candy. It was better than chocolate milk. And we would just play, like, Monopoly and stuff and drink the Bailey's and get these long straws. So, you know, because my parents had a lot of parties, so they had the box of cocktail straws, and I'd make like 30 of them, you know. And this way we could be like really far away from the bar, so when my mom came down to do laundry, she wouldn't know that we were drinking, just drop the straw and pretend we're playing Monopoly. But really we're just trying to get that little train of Bailey's working perfectly with no leaks, you know. And it just took all afternoon. It was great. And then my first real drunk was, I was in seventh grade, so I don't know if I was 12 or 13 years old, but, you know, I set the pattern for what happened to me almost every single time I got drunk for the rest of my drinking career, which was, I started drinking. It felt absolutely amazing and wonderful, and I thought I could conquer the world, and everybody started to look a little better looking. I was definitely better looking. I was the best looking chick at that party by four drinks. I didn't want anybody else to have any of the beer, so I guarded the keg on my first drunk and wanted to beat up anybody that I thought was taking too much. And then I met him, and we left the party together. And I was 12 years old. And we left the party, and I disappeared. And I started fooling around with this kid, and I had never done that. I mean, aside from the unwarranted and unwanted advances of various family members, I had never done that in my life. And so, under the influence and being drunk, you know, I had wound up with hickeys all over me, and feeling totally demoralized and embarrassed and ashamed later that day. So my father came to pick me up the next day from this party, and I had hickeys all over my neck, and the mother of the friend is just screaming about how I caused a ruckus and disappeared. My dad was just like, he just completely blew it off. He's like, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." He's like, "All right, that's it, end of story." And so I just started a pattern there where I pretty much did any substance you put in front of me as long as you said it would make me feel good. And if it made me feel good, then I wanted more, because more had to be better. And so I smoked pot and I drank, and it wasn't until I was in my high school years that I started playing around with other substances, because they were there, you know. So if they were there and you gave them to me, I did them. And I drank to blackout a lot. I drank to throwing up a lot. I was constantly being left the last one at the party, trying to find my way home because I just never wanted it to end. So I would be, I had one boyfriend after another, about 3-4 months, 6 months tops, till that something ended and the next one started. And I was always desperately in love with every single one. And so these events started happening to me, that demoralization started happening over and over again, where I would find myself in a fight with one of my friends in a bar. I started going to bars when I was 15. In New York at that time, because I am 47 years old, I won't make anybody do the math, because I'm 47 years old, so it was like 1986, 1985 when I was going to bars. And in New York at that time, there was no photo on the driver's license. It wasn't like a laminated thing with a holographic image on the other side of it. The permit, you went down, you signed it on a carbon paper, and you got a copy, and they kept a copy, you know? So I would just got real good at forging that, you know? And so 16 became 22 really easily. It's like having a note from your mother. I can come in the bar. And they took that at some places. And so, not that it mattered. I just felt like it's all attitude, you know, just be like, "That's right, I belong," you know, pull my shirt down nice and low. And I usually got in wherever I wanted to go. And so bars were it for me. Like, that was everything I wanted, all in one spot. You know, alcohol, drugs, men, dancing, music, the whole atmosphere. So as soon as you walk in, you just breathe it in and feel like, ah. And if I was lucky enough to get a little buzz on before I got to the bar, then it was just like, I've arrived, you know. Like, I felt like there was a spotlight on me as I made my way to the bar. And that's what alcohol did for me. Every single time I ingested it in the beginning, in the beginning of the night. That's what it always did for me. It just took away every fear, every insecurity that I ever had. No anxiety. No, am I going to fit in? Are you going to like me? You know, am I going to meet somebody? Who's going to drive later? All gone. And so I did that. I did that bar hopping at a really young age. And then I would get into a fight with one of my friends, probably over a guy, or they were stealing my attention, or whatever. I want your lipstick. It didn't really matter. We get into a fight, either a fist fight or just a screaming cat fight, and I'd find myself walking, you know, miles and miles away from home, or hitchhiking. And, yeah, I got myself into some pretty dangerous situations, and I don't know why I'm alive sometimes, the things that I walked through. I can remember being in somebody's car that I hitchhiked from Lindenhurst back to Fresno. There was no cell phones, so there was no calling anybody for help. There was no calling my friends back or texting and saying, "I'm an idiot, can you please come get me?" You know, and besides, I don't know if my pride and ego would have allowed that. And this guy was very creepy, and he was really giving me the creeps, and he said, "You know, nothing's to stop me from killing you and dumping you off the side of the car." So he didn't, and he stopped, and you know, I screamed bloody murder, and he let me off on the side of the road, and I walked home shaking and crying. But like, why not? My God is so huge and powerful that I really can understand him. Like, if I could understand him, he wouldn't be big enough for my needs. And so I don't know that that's God's will, or that God saved me, or that God has a purpose for me. Why would that be me and not the next person who did die? I don't know. I don't need to know. I don't have to figure it out, right? I can just say thank you, God, and really lucky that I made it this far. And so a lot of that kind of stuff happened to me over and over and over again. And I did make it to the end of high school, and at age 18, I was chasing motorcycles. I really, really loved Harley Davidsons and the guys who rode them. And the more tattoos, the better. And that was usually how I would gauge who I was going to go home with that night, was how many tattoos they had and if they were riding a motorcycle. And that wasn't really the best plan. But I found myself around a lot of people in motorcycle clubs back in New York, and found myself in a couple of dicey situations there. And, you know, I could just tell story after story after story of being kicked out of bars. I was kicked out of a club bar, and I just happened to know one of the girls that was a property. And so I didn't get my ass kicked. But the next day they found a girl in a car beaten nearly to death. And it was like a message right behind that bar. And so I had a big mouth. Have I established that? A big mouth. And once I got drunk, I just didn't give a shit. You know, I just didn't care. And I'd say anything to anybody. And I was a hothead. I'm still kind of a hothead, but it's better. And so right about that time, I was getting ready to graduate high school. My father had no confidence whatsoever that I was going to graduate high school. And my father and I had a very combative relationship all through. My parents, you know, loved the hell out of me. I think they struggled with their own drinking and drugs. It was the 80s. Everybody did cocaine. My parents definitely did, and I stole it from them all the time. But my dad was very financially successful and loved his family and was, you know, worked his ass off to provide. And when I was 18 and did manage to graduate high school, they relocated to Fresno, California. And it was like the biggest culture shock ever. Ever. I mean, I was going to bars. I had like 8 bars I could choose from, and I was 18 years old that I could go to. And I came here, and the freaking ID, first of all, was laminated. Like, laminated! And I was like, how the hell am I going to forge this? Like, I don't have a laminator. I don't even know how to do this technology. Like, I found myself in little dive bars in downtown Fresno, you know, bad things continued to happen to me, usually involving, you know, going home with people and waking up and not knowing where the hell I was, and finding bruises, you know, on myself that I didn't know how I got them. And I just bounced around from job to job, and chasing those motorcycles, you know, here in Fresno. And I didn't last long in Fresno. I had a lot of geographics. I moved around a lot. I got back in touch with my birth mother that I hadn't seen in a real long time. And I wound up moving to San Francisco. Then I moved to live with her in Florida. And I blew that up. I just blew it up. You know, I just treated her like shit. Treated her kids like shit. Treated her like she owed me. Took advantage every time I could. Stole her alcohol, stole her pot, you know, came home at 4 in the morning, tromped all over the place, ate her food, left a mess. She kicked me out. So I did that all the time. I just bounced around until people got sick of my shit and asked me to leave. I just didn't, like, move down the street. I moved, like, 3,000 miles away. That's where my geographics were, you know? I've met people that have just moved, like, a zip code, and it was a big deal, man. I just got on Greyhound bus, and phew, I go 3,000 miles. And So I did find myself back here in Fresno in 1991, right after I turned 21 years old. And at 21 years old, I was already tired. You know, I was like tired of bouncing around. I was back living with my parents, and I needed to find work, and I found a job, and I was going to go back to school, and I was going to, you know, it's going to do good this time, really going to get my act together. And then I met this biker. This one had his shit together. He had a house, and he had 3 motorcycles, and he was dealing drugs on the side, and he had a union job, and I was just like, thought I was in like Flynn, you know? I quit school, and then, you know, and then he started beating the shit out of me, and that sucked. And, you know, my track record of how only going like 3 to 6 months in any relationship ended right there, because he said he was going to find me no matter where I went, and buried me 6 feet under the rose garden if I tried to leave. So I actually wound up staying with him for like over a year. That was like a really long fucking time. Especially when you get knocked on your ass because you looked like you didn't know you were even looking at the bartender funny. You know? And I just have to say, I did a shit ton of meth. And so my eyes were always looking funny. You know, it's like, you know, biting my lips and looking around. It's like, you know, and then you're all paranoid because your old man's going to freaking knock you on your ass if it looks like you're flirting with somebody. And it's just like, oh, crazy town. And I got out of there, but because my sister convinced me that he was not going to follow me to my parents' house, that my dad would call our fucking uncles from back east. And there's no way that he would be able to touch me again if I actually wanted to come clean about what was happening to me. So my dad and my sister saved me from that. And within a couple of years, I got sober. So I partied for a while. I kept trying to hold it together. I kept trying to get it together. I worked for my dad selling life insurance. And I just kept promising him all the time, I'm going to do better. I'm going to do better. I'm going to do better. But the truth was, I couldn't show up for an early morning appointment unless I was already up the night before. And I couldn't go to sleep unless I drank myself into passing out. And my dad finally asked me to leave. And it was like the last person in my life that I ever thought was going to finally ask me to leave. And he asked me to get help or get out. So he gave me that little opening. And to this day, that was over 21 years ago, and I can't believe I said okay. Nothing in my life or my history up to that point would lay odds that I would say okay instead of saying, can I curse here? I've already been cursing, but if you don't want me to, okay. Everything in my life pointed to me saying, fuck you. I will find somewhere else. I always land on my feet. There's always a guy willing to take me in or a girlfriend who needs a roommate. But I didn't. That was God working through others, I think. And me being willing to hear it and being just beat down and willing. And there's a lady in Fresno who's got like 45 years, and she always says to the newcomers, if you're ready, you can't hardly screw it up. And if you're not, there's nothing we can do. That's it. And I was ready. There was nothing I could have done at that point to screw it up. You know, I got into a treatment center because that is the only thing I could think to do, was call this number that was on the back of my insurance card, because I was still floating a job with my dad. And they took me in for an intake that was called Cedar Vista. It was up in Fresno. It's not around anymore. And on this intake, this guy just asked me to tell him my whole story and write down how much substances I did in any given day, week, or month. And by the end of that appointment, he said, you desperately need inpatient treatment. Like, I don't even think you can detox on your own. If you don't get into treatment, you're going to die. And I am such a drama queen, too. You know, I went home like, I'm going to die. I got to go to treatment. I said goodbye to my siblings. I packed my bags, you know. And then they called me back and said, your insurance won't let you go inpatient. I was like, well, could have gone back out, right? But I didn't. I was like, well, what will they let me do, you know? So they said outpatient, and I went to outpatient, and I detoxed just, you know, without any medication and skin crawling and just heebie-jeebies and these lights in that meeting. It was just like, ah, just like raw nerves. I mean, if anybody here is in that new, like, I'll never forget that feeling. I hope I don't forget it at any amount of sobriety that I have, that horrible raw feeling that like the lights had x-rays in them, you know, and that like that by looking at me, you can see my deepest, darkest secrets because it's too fucking bright in here. And I didn't like when people just like look me directly in the eye. I just be like, what do you want? You know, what are you trying to find out? Like, stop looking at me, you know. I'd rather you looked at my tits at that time in my life than look me straight in the eye. That is not the case anymore. But that, honestly, it was like, I don't have to be honest with you and like tell you any truth if you're not looking me in the eye. I mean, I felt like a piece of shit. I didn't want to look anybody in the eye, not even myself, in the mirror. And the things I'd done and the people that I'd hurt, there's just not even enough time to go into it. Because I want to tell you about my journey in sobriety. And so I met a group. I was actually here at this meeting in March with a lot of the ladies from the group that I got sober in Fresno. And when I got out of my outpatient center, they said, you know, you got to find a home group and a sponsor. And I went to this women's meeting. And you know how I knew that was a place for me? Because they talked to me after the meeting. And they circled a meeting schedule. And they said, after the meeting, they gave me this meeting schedule with all the meetings that all the ladies that went to the meeting had circled, who goes on Monday, who goes on Tuesday, who goes on Wednesday, who goes on Thursday. Every night of the week, there was some meeting circled that one of the ladies in that room would be at. So it would be a familiar face, like a safety net. You know, and here I'd been bouncing around for 7 weeks, waiting to feel comfortable somewhere. Like, it was just going to be like, oh, I'm the meeting for you. I thought somebody was going to do that to be my sponsor, too, by the way. Like, hi, I'm your new sponsor. And I was like, what the fuck? I don't want to ask somebody. What if they say no? I might die of rejection. And so they invited me to coffee after the meeting. I was like, I don't drink coffee. My addictive specialist says I should be off caffeine. And they're like, you can drink decaf, you know, have an ice cream. I'm like, I'm on a diet. I don't eat ice cream. And they're like, just come to the fucking coffee shop. Okay. What else did I have to do? I was honestly probably going to leave there and go eat a half gallon of ice cream at home by myself because I had nothing else to do. So I went to that coffee shop and I sat down next to this lady and she's asking me, you know, what are you doing for work? I was like, well, I'm about to go on disability because I went to see this addictive specialist and he thinks I'm not really fit to work and I should focus on getting sober. She said, fuck that. If you don't go to work, you're going to drink. She said, what else are you going to do all day? How long does it take to read through the book? You're not going to read the book all day. You're not going to read the book all day. You're going to read the book and then you're going to watch TV. Why don't you go get a job? And I guarantee you a job will keep you sober longer than disability will. And I was like, all right, nobody ever talked to me like that before. So I was like, okay. And I didn't say F you either. I was like, okay. She's like, and tomorrow night the book study is at my house. I wrote the address on the schedule. Come on over. And I was like, okay. And so the next night I went there and they all said, well, we're going to eat over at Fashion Fair. You want to come with us? I was like, okay. So every night I met somebody and they said, you want to go tomorrow? Yeah, are you going tomorrow? Aren't you going tomorrow? And I go, okay. You know, so I just went. I just followed along and I got a crappy ass telemarketing job that I was great at. Because I also am very competitive. I don't know if that's an alcoholic thing, but it does say in the book that we make the best employees for a reason. You know, I don't want to look bad. I don't like to look bad. If there's a board on the wall, my name must be on the top. And if it's not on the top, I'll work my ass off till it is. So I don't know if that's good or bad or making your defects work for you, but... So I kept doing it, you know, and I worked the steps. And, you know, I did the fourth step very thoroughly. I was asked to write my entire life story, which I did. Although when I started dragging my feet, my sponsor said, that's enough of that shit. Start writing shorthand. code words. You know, I want it done by the end of the month. She gave me a deadline. And you know, from that fourth step, I was able to write, once I did my fifth, my sixth, and my seventh, I was able to write my eighth step list of amends. Came directly from my list of resentments from my fourth step. And that was only my first list of amends, by the way. And I was such a thief that my amends had to be separated into financial and non-financial. And so my financial amends ranged from $3.75 at the KFC from bullying the lady into giving me a free meal. Well, actually, when I didn't bully her into giving me a free meal, I bullied her so badly because they didn't have boneless... I'm going to cover my face while I say this. They didn't have boneless honey roasted wings. I really needed those. And she insisted that they'd never had them. And I was like, that's just a fucking lie. I want to talk to a manager. And so I was crazy. And they were so flustered by the end of the conversation with me that they forgot to ask for my money. And I drove off. And I didn't write it on my amends list because I was like this. I got free chicken. I got over, you know. So I wrote it down because I got over, you know. So I did. And so they ranged from that all the way up to, like, I think when I calculated my father's amends, my parents' amends, it was like $5,000 from all the things that I'd stolen from them over the years and the cars that I dinged. And then there was the movie theaters that I embezzled like $6,000 from with a ring of thieves. So we would just resell the tickets. So if you brought your ticket up, you know, to the usher, and you'd rip it in half, right? If there was like five people in a row, he'd take all five of their tickets and he'd just rip two, give you each a half, and hold the whole ones in the hand. I'm not giving you ideas, by the way. They don't do this. They don't do it like this anymore, right? And then somebody would courier all that stack of tickets out to us in the middle of the mall where the little booth was, and then I just like, and I'd hand you a ticket instead of letting it come out of the machine, you know what I mean? And keep a little tally, and at the end of the night, well, that time it was like $4.75 for a ticket. At the end of the night, $4.75 times, I did that 100 times on a busy Saturday, it's $475 for like four of us to split. Yeah, it's bar money. So anyway, I had that stuff on my amends list, and I had stealing from Comcast cable because I had one of those broken boxes that you get all pay-per-view all day long. I had a really mean sponsor, man. She didn't even calculate like how many hours of the day I watched stolen cable and approximate how many freaking movies that I stole at $9.95 each and tally it all out. Just calculating that took me like a week. And then I threw that box away, and then she made me get it back out of the garbage and bring it to Comcast and make amends. And they wanted to arrest me. But I did it anyway, because I was willing to go to any length. And so then they didn't want to arrest me. They're like, well, in exchange, we'll let you do a PSA. I was like, oh, hell no. No. You don't understand the people I used to hang out with. If I'm doing a PSA for stealing cable, they're going to think I ratted them out and ratted a bunch of people out on all kinds of shit, like you're putting my life in danger. And so I went back, and this was like a group conference. This was like three of the women in the group with the most time that had to powwow on this like three times to decide whether or not I should do it. And the response kept coming up. You have to be willing to go any length, and you have to leave it in God's hands. And so I did. I mean, I didn't do the PSA. Thank God. But I did call him and tell him I was willing to do it. And then my higher power stepped in and I didn't have to. That's how I believe that went down. I was willing to go to any length. And I called them twice and told them I was willing to do it. And they never called me back. And so like one of the things in AA, like in my life that happens in AA. Wow, time's running out fast. So this is over at 8, right? So that was really young in sobriety. And those kinds of things that I did kept me sober through the really horrible, shitty things that happened in sobriety that you just can't help, like life happening, you know, like people getting sick and divorce, almost losing my house to foreclosure, sicknesses, illnesses, kids with problems, you know, all that stuff just happens. It doesn't not happen just because you're sober. So I met a him at 3 years sober. I got obsessed. I chased him around till he asked me out. Then he knocked me up. We moved in. We had two kids. We got divorced. That's the short story. And so that all right there just took 11 years. So I have two kids that are now 16 and 11, and they've never seen me drink. Because I had them in sobriety. You know, things that I've had to go through in sobriety. To have those two kids, I had to have 4 miscarriages. So I was pregnant 6 times in that marriage to have those two kids. Is it because I had abortions when I was drinking? I don't know. It's because I had venereal diseases from sleeping around when I was young? I don't know. Is it because I had bad DNA or I waited until I was sober to have my kids so I was in my 30s? I don't know. Whatever the reason, I'm so grateful I have them. And I was able to walk through all that guilt and shame, you know, every time. I did this, I'm bad, I'm a dirty slut. All those things I would tell myself and stay sober. And then share it and be able to stand up here and tell you that. Just in case it helps you get through a day when you want to drink over feeling really horrible. Because I heard people say it. And then I learned through speaker meetings that I wasn't bad. I was sick. I was sick with a disease of alcoholism. And that when I pick up a drink, that's what kind of shit happens. And I had no power over it. If I could make a decision, I wouldn't decide to do the things that I did. Today I get to make decisions and do things. Because I have sanity. So one of the most powerful things that I got to go through, I'm going to try to share this without crying because it's been a rough year. But aside from, you know, stuff with my kids, I have a son with special needs. He's on the autism spectrum, and he's been suicidal twice in his life over bullying and problems at school. My birth mother that I got in touch with sporadically, walked through her getting cancer and dying, last year. And then my father got sick. My father was my hero. He got me sober. He rescued me every time I needed rescuing in my whole life, especially when I needed him to not actually rescue me but kick me out, you know. So we had a great relationship. We ran our family restaurant in Fresno, Mother Mary's, together, and worked there a lot the last few years of his life. And he came down with this weird bone marrow disorder and started to get real ill. And this last summer he had a bone marrow transplant in July. The first time I've spoken since this, but anyway, my dad passed in August, and it was a horrifying experience and a miracle and a wonderful experience all at the same time, because I'm sober and present. And I did meet a wonderful man in sobriety. I waited a year to date, and we got married 3 years after we started dating. We've been married 3 years now, so we've been together 6 years. And he supported me financially over that whole summer, you know, and allowed me to quit my job and just work at my internship so that I could travel back and forth to see my dad as needed and spend a week at a time with him up in UCSF. And so my father had a stroke right after the bone marrow transplant, and he couldn't communicate. And he said this really great thing, it's really horrible and great thing to me in the ICU. And he said, at first I didn't like you. Thank you. At first I didn't like you, but now I see that you're okay. That was the best he could do with the stroke and communicating. And although I had my feelings hurt and went home and cried because I knew he loved my sister better than me, what I realized is, you know, he appreciated that I could communicate with the doctors, but I've always been a pushy broad. And he didn't like that at first, you know, and he was afraid I was going to piss the doctors off. And then he realized that he needed me there, and I was able to be his voice. And I was able to be his voice when we needed to take him off life support, because he articulated to me how much he did not want that. And then I had to stand up for him with my mom and the rest of the family to give him what he wanted, and that is all a result of this program. And then last week I graduated from Fresno State. I went back to school, so I went, it's never too late. I went back to school 6 years ago and I got my bachelor's degree. And 3 days after my graduation, on Monday the 22nd, I started my job at a tomato processing plant over here in Lemoore. And I finally have like a salary and sick days and a retirement, and it's fucking amazing. Like, I'm almost 50, and it's okay that I'm just starting out, like, you know, getting the things that I really, really wanted in my life, because I took care of my kids, I took care of my parents, you know, and I'm just like so grateful for AA and the opportunity to have been here and share that with you guys tonight. So thank you.